This lecture is entitled One in Four. During the next few days, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, yes, I will be discussing things that have a high probability. Tomorrow, I will discuss aging, and Thursday, death. There will be a lighter interlude on Wednesday night, when I discuss my life with the pigs. I will open today, as is my custom on most of these, with some readings from George MacDonald, the remarkable Scotch cleric of the 1800s, and who was probably most, his writings were probably the most responsible for the conversion of C.S. Lewis. If your trouble is such that you cannot appeal to him, the more need you should appeal to him. And then on anxiety, all the morning he was busy with his heart in trying to content himself beforehand with whatever fate the Lord might intend for him. As yet he was more of a Christian philosopher than a philosophical Christian. The thing most disappointing to him, he would treat as the will of God for him and try to make up his mind to it, persuading himself it was the right and best thing, as if he knew it to be the will of God. He was thus working in the region of supposition and not of revealed duty, in his own imagination and not in the will of God. There is something in the very presence and actuality of a thing to make one able to bear it. But a man may weaken himself for bearing what God intends him to bear by trying to bear what God does not intend him to bear. We have no right to school ourselves to an imaginary duty. When we do not know, then what he lays upon us is not to know. Cancer, tumors, neoplasia, and such is our subject as we discuss it under the title One in Four. Never in the history of medicine have we faced such a bewildering, such a difficult yet intriguing problem. The title stems from the fact that unless new preventative and control measures are found, one quarter of the people in the United States will develop a tumor sometime in their life. If you count probably all the benign ones, perhaps it'll be higher than this. I think we are all sobered by these statistics. I'm sure this will be your experience, as it has been mine in the recent past. When you get my age and you've been 39 for a few years, then You can recall, as I can in the very recent past, I have helped bear the pall of three of my friends who were very near and dear to me, who were victims of cancer. Now, in my discussion today, many of you are probably wondering, well, what am I doing discussing cancer? Well, my area of endeavor for the past 18 years, I guess, has been in the area of radiation biology. And it is a tragic paradox that radiation is one of the more effective carcinogenic agents, that is, one capable of producing tumors and cancer. It is also probably one of our best means for treatment and also for diagnosis. So I'm going to start out, and I'm going to give some of the characteristics of cancer after a definition. We'll try to assess the dimension of the problem. I will bring in probably some of the radiation experience in this, in causing tumors, in diagnosis, and in treatment. And fortunately, the physicians here, Drs. Peterson and Hodges, are delaying their departure for Holden Lake to be with us this morning to answer questions, discuss this, to interrupt me when I'm, incorrect in some of my assumptions. In the course of the conversation, too, or this discussion, I will mention tobacco along with radiation as a rather ineffective carcinogenic agent. So let us then turn to the definition. I have defined, as others have, that a neoplasm or a tumor is an autonomous new growth of tissue. We're sort of questioning this now, rather relative to its autonomy. I think I'll explain that as we proceed. And if I don't, you remind me of it. But it's sort of a tissue that has sort of gone wild, sort of. It has lost its control. There's no restriction sort of on its growth, or at least it's lost some of its control for growth. Not that some of our tissues, our tissues have sort of a capacity, some of them at least, for unlimited growth. But they sort of know when to stop. I mean, there's a lot of tissue that grows faster than tumors. If you cut yourself, there might be a very rapid regrowth of tissue. But after it heals, sort of closes, it'll stop. This is not the case in some tumors. Some of them are, however, slow growing, but we'll get into that in a minute. I think that's enough of that. Now, we often hear the term cancer, and that's usually now we refer to it as a malignant neoplasm. But then I better get to defining what malignancy is, and we'll refer to our new projector. We classify usually tumors in many quarters now is not utilized so much. More people are probably speaking of it as neoplasms or calling them by their right name or assessing the right name, but I think you can use tumor if you want to. Now, in the classification, we set up certain criteria. Here it's growth rate and limit. We then try to define, and this is, of course, is very critical to you and I as we go to the physician. He gives us a complete examination and then says, well, you have a tumor. And I think most of the question then is it malignant? Yeah. All right. How do we define these? Well, I can't draw a line right down between benign and malignant, and a lot of other people can't either. But generally speaking, the growth rate and limit on a benign tumor, it's usually slow and limited. And a good example here are some of these papillomas on your skin or your warts. I mean, they might grow up some. In animals, we have very extensive papillomas sometimes over maybe a large part of the front of a calf or something. But they are encapsulated. And if you've ever pulled your warts out, you can kind of pull them out. I used to have one here, pulled it out when the lectures were uninteresting or something. I mean, it's quite well encapsulated. Now, they might grow to be quite large, however. The malignant one, usually we speak of it as more rapid and relatively unrestricted. I've already started in on encapsulation. And usually on a benign tumor, there's a capsule to it. In a malignant tumor, there might be a capsule partially, but the tumor doesn't respect the tissue capsule. In every case. Now, effect on the host, generally speaking, it's insignificant. It automatically blows. I was wondering when it's going to start blowing here to cool it off. I know of tumors, say, in a cow where you have an ovarian tumor, but a benign one that might weigh several hundred pounds. Now, that's a lot of stuff to be jumping up and down in there. And I'm sure it probably affected the animal if it had to run, And that's quite a bit to carry around, even for a 700-pound cow, if you have a couple of hundred pounds of ovary in there, ovarian tumor. So it isn't always that a benign tumor may not affect. Or in a benign tumor sometimes of the thyroid, it may be quite large and certainly on a lady affect the conformation of the neck. Usually on a malignant tumor, it may be of some significance, in fact, very great significance in many cases. Now, if you're going to have a tumor, and a malignant one, there are some you should take in preference to others. This will become evident as we go through here. I mean, I think my, if I had to have a choice right now, I don't know. I mean, I'm kind of a prejudice to the thyroid. Now, if you look at a metastasis, that is, tumors have the property that they're sort of growing out here, and that's sort of where the thing cancer came from. It's like a crab, and sort of projections grow out, and they'll invade the capillaries, the blood vessels, and then they'll sort of clip off, and cells will be shed, and these cells then will travel your circulatory system and then settle some other place. It may be the lung, the liver are pretty good sites. Not too many metastases to the heart, some to the brain. And of course, there's also metastases. Sort of they might break off and invade the area around the tumor site, the primary tumor site. In a benign tumor, certainly one of its criteria is that there is no metastases. However, you run into troubles here too. We do in the thyroid, I know. There's some big arguments is in an adenoma of the thyroid, and I should mention, while I think of it, to point out here why I say that the tumor incidence may be higher than 1 in 4. Because I think it was a fellow in Minnesota, in fact, that he did a whole series of autopsies on people. He did very careful ones, about 1,000. And he had very good material on the thyroid, which is it's a gland right here in the neck, regulates metabolism. And he found that in about 50% of all the people that he autopsied over 50 years of age had adenomas of the thyroid. And many of them, of course, didn't know it. And they're very small. I showed you some the other day, some of you. There's a sort of little nodules there, and the person may well go through life in good shape and make out all right. Undiagnosed. Mitosis, that is, how many cells are multiplying. And when you're laying out on the table and they've done a laparotomy on you or something, an exploratory, and you're sound asleep, they may take if they see something suspicious, they'll take a section and they'll run to the pathologist to do maybe a frozen section. And one of the things that pathologist does is to check to see how wild the thing this is. You see. How many cells are multiplying in here? How many mitosis? How many cells are in division? And then they'll grade them, like in your stomach carcinoma or something, just to see how wild it is. And that's where the decision may be made, whether to just sew me or you back up and say, well, it's just a matter of a short time. Recurrence, it's unusual for a benign tumor. It's relatively unusual for a benign tumor to reoccur. However, in a malignancy, you may often have recurrences. You may also often have a cure. On differentiation, by that we mean how well does the tissue, the tumor tissue, or the neoplastic tissue, resemble the original structure. In other words, of the thyroid, how does it? Can you look at it and say, boy, this looks almost like thyroid tissue, you know? Or does it look pretty wild, like it's very undifferentiated? And this is another thing that the pathologist looks at as he examines the tissue. Yes? Unrestricted. I think that's enough for that. Now, if that doesn't bother you, and then I'll go along because I have another one to put on here. Now, on structure and growth, I have a category for that. And generally speaking, the tumor does resemble tissue of origin. And it grows along the lines of least resistance. And of course, a blood supply, it requires this. So that's usually invades the mass. And I think that's enough to say on that. And this, I think, is an important area, is under nomenclature. Just how do you call them, you know? I mean, the doctor says you have something or other, and just what does this mean? Well, there is some order to this chaos, but it's not real good. But generally speaking, the benign tumors are generally named for the cell of origin, and then suffixed with oma, O-M-A. I'll give you an example of this, like or osteoid tissue, which is bone. Oma would be then the suffix for a benign tumor. You'd call it osteoma. Or hepato from the liver, hepatic, hepatoma would be a benign tumor of the liver. Now, when you get into malignant stuff, usually they speak of it as a cancer. However, there's also, you'll hear terms like fibrosarcoma, adenosarcoma. There you're adding, well, it takes a little explanation. There are really three layers of which your body is constructed. It's the surface layer, which is of epithelial, we call it epithelium or epithelial origin. Well, in the old days, we used to say a tumor of epithelial origin, such as the lining of a gland, you'd call that adeno, and then you'd add carcinoma for any of the epithelial tissue, carcinoma. If you get into blood vessels, that is tissue of a muscle and nerve and so forth, then you often go to you add the suffix sarcoma, but maybe that just confuses. Fibrous tissue would be fibrosarcoma, and it kind of goofs up because when you get to skin, you often have a layer of skin which is squamous cells. They're flattened cells, so you call it a squamous cell carcinoma rather than something else. But that gives you some idea. But usually when you hear of just oma, it's kind of a good, if you were worried and he tells you something that ends in oma without carcinoma or sarcoma on it, that might be good. But if it's cancer, which is the term now used often rather than sarcoma or carcinoma, then you may have a problem. I may have a problem. Predisposition. We do have a certain predisposition by species, by age and breed. Maybe it's just as good a time as any, and I will show it more later, but the people who have my coloring will have a greater incidence of skin cancer than someone with dark skin. Gray horses, you'll be interested in this. Gray horses that are at least 16 to 18 years of age will have about a 80% chance of having melanosarcoma or melanoma. This is fantastic, but it's true. And that's one that you're better off not having. If you're a horse or a person. In the dogs, a lot of people have asked me, well, why do you use beagle dogs for your experiments? Well, one reason we use beagle dogs for experiments with radiation, we are feeding some of these dogs bone-seeking radionuclides, radiostrontium and radium. And in this case, they're very useful because these elements concentrate in the bone. Well, your blood is formed in bone marrow. And so you can say, well, these animals should manifest, at least a certain percentage of them should manifest, probably a leukemia-type complex. That is I hesitate to use the word cancer, although often categorized now in a cancer, or a cancer of the bone. Well, beagles have an exceedingly low incidence. natural incidence of leukemia and bone cancer. Some of your large breeds have quite a high incidence. And in dogs, it's essentially a function of weight of the animal. And a lot of your working dogs have a rather high incidence of bone cancer. And cancer is not restricted to just mammals. I mean, we see it in, cancer of the grinding stomach of the oyster, bumblebee salivary gland, recall? I mean, ants have it, trees have it. On the way to Holden, you'll probably see some trees with some kind of a, looks like a neoplasm. And so we have this type of situation. I've mentioned also, as we get on incidence, we're going to somewhere I say I think that that there will be 300,000 deaths per year from cancer. It's the greatest killer next to heart disease. And in women, I mentioned we have a sort of 1 in 4 situation. In man, it's about 1 to 5. Of course, however, that is changing somewhat as we get older. Generally speaking, you see, the incidence of cancer has increased from 1900 rather remarkably. But we have to die from something, you see, and as we grow older and we're saving more people, chances are more of them will die from cancer. Of course, that isn't the only reason. We're being assaulted by more agents that are not really good for us. And I'm not going to take the blame for fallout for a lot of this. Now, probably of interest to you would be some of the incidence of the various tumors. Can you see that? So we'll look at that for a minute. After I say that we'll have close to 500,000 new cases this year that will be found. However, in 5 years, probably 200,000 of them will be still alive. But I should hasten to point out that probably another 100,000 would be saved if they had early diagnosis and proper treatment. There is steady progress in the treatment of these. We'll hear about that in a little while. Well, let's look at this now. This is the percent incidence by organ and system. Your chances of having a cancer or tumor in the brain, you see, are quite small. Now, this is in comparison, figuring that of all the cancer cases, how many are in these various systems. You hear a lot about leukemia, for example. You see where leukemia is here. Right there, yeah. I'm kind of shaky. But here, these are men, and these are women over here. And you hear so much about leukemia, you know, and figure about every other person is going to get leukemia. Well, they really don't. The greatest incidence, looking under men, is 2.2. Don't confuse this. Breast tumor in men isn't real high. No, wait now. Excuse me. There. These are females. Let's look at females first. I'm all goofed up here. Let's look at females first. I look like I had a decimal there. I guess maybe females don't have so much brain cancer because they don't use their brains too much. It might also be because of weight. I don't know. Their brain may be smaller, right? But brain cancer is not a real good thing to have. Although, because that's kind of a hard place to really cut out, because you can get along with quite a bit of it, but there's some parts of it you can't really do well without. And although our methods of diagnosis now are really remarkable, using one of the newer isotopes, indium and also technetium-99, these are isotopes you've never heard of, but they have remarkable properties because you can inject very small amounts, and now we have devices that have been developed in the nuclear energy where this material goes into the blood, of course, and it circulates, and then it's sort of a function of the metabolism of the part, how much goes to where. And using these methods, You can delineate just where something is haywire, you know, up in your head. And they do this by a scanning device, you see, because this is radioactive in here. And this thing looks through a very small aperture, and then it's put on film or some other system, and it's marked out. So you end up with sort of something that looks like your head, and the darkness is sort of a function of how much is concentrated, and you can get a real nice picture. I should really have brought some of these to you. It's really remarkable the way they can delineate. So you lay them on their head this way and get sort of a look at their brain, and then you put them the other way, and you can relocate this. And sometimes it may be just an abscess there, and it can be removed. This happened to a friend of mine. They got really shook up about him because he's lost sort of his ability to sort of manipulate. It turned out it was only an abscess. And you can delineate it well this way, and it's nice to know where to go in here, you know, before you open it up, rather than to have to take off the large calvarium. It's hard to cut through. Most skulls are very thick. Yes. Now, now the mouth, you see there's quite a difference in the mouth between male and female, 2 verses 6.2. Now part of this is that a lot of women, I think partially, that quite a few women, and they don't smoke pipes, because I think some of the contribution of these skin cancers are from pipe smoking. On respiration, on respiratory tract, you see there's quite a difference there too, 2.5 to 12. You will, however, I think predictably in the next decade or two, there will be a great increase among women. And I'll get to more of this later, but more women are smoking now. And if you're going to have a tumor, if you're going to have a cancer, this is one place you're better off not having it. On the breast, well, there, as I started to say before I got confused, this is a rather high incidence in women. You see, 22% of all cancers are of the breast. And strangely enough, the higher incidence are in unmarried people. Unmarried women or women who do not have children. Interestingly, too, in dogs, I mean, you hardly ever see a mammary carcinoma in a dog that has been spayed, that has been castrated. However, in our beagles, we have about a 50% incidence of cancer of the uterus or the mammary gland at 12 years of age, when half of them are gone. Where we probably wouldn't see any if we took out their ovaries at an early age. The digestive tract, and that's another one sort of to avoid, but it's kind of hard to avoid. And you see a higher incidence in men than women. That is partially related to smoking, probably. The genital tract, higher in women. A urinary, and that includes the ovaries. Urinary tract, so you see some discrepancies. I've already discussed leukemia, and then there's skin. And you see more men have it than women. And this is because men, at least up till now, until people started to sunbathe a great deal, and more men were out in the elements. And this is interesting then, as we go just south of there, when you get to over here, you see, what that means, let's see now, what does W mean? Oh, that's white, yes. That's white people, and these are non-white. And the end, let's see, that's north, that's south, okay? And you see an incidence here of 20 per 100,000. In the south, there's 72, and roughly more than a factor of 3 of those people who live in the south versus the north, because they have mainly actinic rays, mainly sun rays, you see? I see a lot of you out sunning yourself. I mean, it's really popular now to be very tan, you know? People speak of a healthy tan. It's ridiculous. It's an unhealthy tan. I mean, my kids make so much fun of me because I have such white, not only skinny legs, but white legs, you know? And they're ashamed of me, you know, when I go to the swimming pool. I got enough things going against me as far as my lifespan goes. It's no use taking on any more. And so I don't expose myself to the sun very much. I don't believe in sunning myself very much because it is unhealthy. Now, if I were Negroid, I wouldn't worry so much about it because the incidence, you see, verses 8, 8, a white person in the South, 72 per 100,000, there's only 4 per 100,000, you see. Of course, now maybe some of them don't live as long, and you have to always be alert for the statistics because there's liars, there's damn liars, and then there's statistical liars, you know, but because when you look at somebody, you gotta be alert. Now, you see, in women, it's considerably lower. That's 2.6. That's 2.6 here, I think. No, it isn't. That's men. No, that's 26. That's right. 26 and 120. That's right. It goes along with what we had up above. That's right. More men have it than women. But this is not so true, you see, among the Negroids. Of course, maybe there is. A lot of times the women are out doing the work out inside and the men are doing something else. All right, the lung. I thought I might get in a pitch here. I'll hit beating the weed a little later, but can you... I put down the lung. When you're smoking about 2 packs a day, chances are 1 in 10 that you're going to have lung carcinoma. And that's... If you're playing Russian roulette, you really wouldn't play it under those circumstances. If you're less than 1 pack a day, about smoking cigarettes, about 1 in 36. While if you're not smoking, the chances are about 1 in 270. Now, let me see, where am I? You can't hear me? Oh, I'm sorry, you wave your hand, you know. I should look at you when I talk. I give this big talk last night, and then I'm not talking loud enough. Usually people complain I'm too noisy. But now, what are some predisposal? Predisposition. All right, heredity. It's often that we see that twins may show up with the same tumor at about the same time. And there is, to an extent, a familial predisposition. I mean, there are some families who are sort of relatively cancer-free, even though they grow to be very old, or maybe that's one reason they grow very old, while others sort of die young with cancer. And certainly we have these in animals. Right now, you can write an order to, say, Bar Harbor, Maine, to Jackson Lab, and you say, I want a mouse that has a 50% incidence of mammary carcinoma at the age of 12 months or 18 months. Probably you can get something like this. Or I want a mouse that has a very low incidence of cancer. And I've used these mice in radiation studies. Ordered up, I got a cross between the C57 black and the 101. There's a very low incidence of tumors. Well, this is very handy if you're studying tumors. You can get another one that has an exceedingly high incidence of lung adenomas. Maybe 75% at 18 months of age. Or you can get a strain, I forgot now. But I used a lot at Stanford on studying lymphoma, where most of them will die by 15 months with a lymphoma or leukemia type complex. So we know there's a familial sort of a predisposition to this. We also have what we call a milk factor. This was quite a finding in the early days in research. They found out that there are a certain high incidence of cancer in a strain of mice. And they wondered, well, how is this transmitted to the young? So what they did, they took the mice that were born to the high incidence strains, they put them on a low incidence strain, and they had a low incidence. They took some low incidence mice, young ones, and had them nurse the high incidence mother, and they ended up with a high incidence strain. So in other words, there was something, some agent in the milk that was causing the cancer in these mice. And this is, of course, we get into this virus thing. And there's more and more thinking now that although we haven't definitely proven in man, it's certainly suggestive that viruses are probably involved in some tumors. There have been a few cases in the United States where there has been quite a focus of an incidence of, say, a leukemia. There's also been some cases where it looks very suspicious where an animal had a leukemia and the child also came down with it. And my associates are very suspicious of this. And next door to my
toward the laboratory in which I worked at the University of California. They have what they call a bovine leukemia project. Certain cattle have a very high incidence of leukemia. And they're interested, of course, is there any relationship between this and virus, and can it be transferred to other animals? So there's very extensive, the amount of your tax dollar that's going into cancer research right now is very substantial. But it's a very perplexing problem. And we can't just say that this is what causes cancer. It's more like a sort of a general situation where you can produce cancer with radiation, you can produce it with some chemical agents, you can produce it with certain hormones and other things. When we discuss senility as a predisposition, the incidence generally increases with age. I've already mentioned hormones. There are certain hormones that we can administer and produce tumor. There are some that are dependent on a hormone. If you take prostate cancer in man, it's essentially dependent on probably testosterone, at least some of them are. And so how do they treat them sometimes? And sometimes it's effective. They either castrate the person, or they might feed them estrogens. Very effective. The physicians may want to comment on this. I've already mentioned the viruses. There are definitely, I mean, we have isolated viruses. I mean, there's viruses in mice which produce tumors in mice. It's well documented. It's true also in I think there's one now described in a dog, described in a cat, in chickens. This was one of the early ones. So they're making good progress on this. There are also certain parasites, worm parasites, that may end up with producing cancer. Certainly chemical agents. The first fellow who showed this was way back many years ago in England. There was a 1700s or something, 1775, old Sir Percival Potts noted that these little chimney sweeps, who were always, they never took very many baths, and they were always associated with sort of tar derivative-like things, coal tar derivatives, showed a high incidence of cancer. And so we have utilized, of course, this finding in studying cancer. And there are certain agents that you can concentrate, and boy, you can put on your skin, and it's a good, I mean, you can cause cancer, you know, no question about it, in a relatively short period of time in animals. And when you're working with it, you don't sort of throw it around. Now, where do we go from here? We got to cover some ground. I think we can just go right into some of the, you see that? Well, that's a mess, isn't it? Oh, let's leave it there for a while. Now, if you have it, what do you do about it, sort of? Well, you have to sort of become steeled to it, and you have to sort of play the statistics game. I hesitate really to put this up here, and maybe I shouldn't really, because these are some years old now, and the advances that have been made since this was developed have really been substantial. Really substantial, and you physicians may wish to comment on this, but you can sort of take your choice here. And I mentioned lung. This is a bad one, because when you get cancer of the lung, this happens to be the 5-year cure rate, you see, and this is years along here, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 years. And you often use this in evaluating sort of arrest or cure. This is the percent survival. In other words, all right, you discovered cancer, so you try to do something about it, maybe. And you see that after about 5 years, or even less than that, after 2 years, less than 10% of them are still alive. So this is sort of the statistics they may play. Now, in the prostate, in man here, you're quite a bit better off, you see. This is sort of a logarithmic scale here. This is linear, so you... But stomach is also a very bad one. But I was surprised to see cervix quite so low. I'd say on the cervix now, this would be higher. Because on cervical cancer, and you correct me if I'm wrong, boy, if you really diagnose this early, you can catch it early. I think you're over 90% ready now, aren't you? I talked to somebody about this recently. I was surprised to see breast as high up close to cancer, but you may wish to comment on this. Ovarian is less, and there again, take out this lung. We don't have a real good working model on women on the lung yet, or it wasn't when this was written. But this will increase with women. Because there's now more women than men smoking. More youngsters. Let's look at smoking for a minute. For a long time, you know, people said, well, it was just the sort of pious people or somebody that were hollering about smoking or somebody that really had missionary fervor. Well, a fellow named Sir Alton Oxner at New Orleans became very interested in this back in 1936. And he wasn't, I don't think, a real reformer as such, but he pointed out this. But of course, most people didn't believe it because a large percentage, certainly of the scientists and men in medicine, I'd say probably more than half of them were smoking. But as the data accumulated, we realized that not only were we showing an increased incidence in lung carcinoma, but as the data piled up, we found out that your chances of dying are really increased in a number of areas. Lung cancer is increased by a factor of at least 11. Emphysema, where you're losing lung function, really, it's increased by a factor of 6. You become essentially an invalid too early in life. I think it was well shown in the case of my father-in-law. He did quit smoking, I think, probably when he was 50, in his 50s, chief, right? 50, something like this. But he'd beat the weed most of his life. And then he got to retirement, and he was, well, he could walk a block, and then he'd be panting like an Airedale, you know? I mean, and the children missed a lot, where he could have had a great time, huh? But he was an invalid because he ended up with an emphysema in the lung. Now, there's some interesting work going on in this using horses. Horses also develop an emphysema, and they're a very good model for man in this. But that's another one of the hazards. There's also an increased hazard of cancer in what we call the T-zone, not only in the lung, but from here on down to the lung. There's about a 4 to 5 times increase in cancer of that region in smokers. Coronary heart disease, you essentially double incidence of cancer. I mean of heart disease from this. And also of the stomach and ulcers, probably increased up to about a factor of 3 times, right? Yes?
Do you have any feeling as to why, with these findings, that the cigarette companies are coming out with the 100 millimeter long cigarette, and that these are going over and really selling with great success?
Yeah, people, of course, are concerned on here, but when you're hooked, I mean, it's very difficult to break this habit, you know, and especially, and I tell you for your children's sake, I mean, most of you I can't do anything with, because you're really hooked and you've tried it, you know, you're like Mark Twain, you know, I mean, easiest thing he ever did, he quit 100 times. You know, but some people, and I've seen them go through this, and boy, for a year, boy, it was really misery. Some people, maybe after an operation or something. I mean, this happened to Walt Bowman. I mean, he was really beating the weed pretty hard. And then he had an operation on diaphragm. You know, he had diaphragmatic hernia, and after he woke up from this, he just didn't really have a desire for it, and that was the end of it. You know, now they have Cigarettes Anonymous and all, but this is a very difficult thing. But the hazard is when you start beating the weed early, you know. I mean, a lot of people now are starting in at 11 and 12. I mean, we smoked then, but we smoked dried clover blossoms and sour dock, you know. I mean, kind of a mixture. You really don't get hooked on this. And then usually your parents catch you. That was sort of the end of that. But Now we do permit this, and it is very disheartening for me to see how many here, how many youngsters are really beating the weed here. And not from as a reformer, but I know what's going to happen to you. I mean, and why? I mean, of a group, huh, who has shown the greatest reduction in cigarette smoking, even though the pressure is probably greatest on physicians. I mean, they're going at it all the time, and when the pressure is greater, you smoke more. But I think as a group, In this data that you gave me, Dr. Muck, you know, I mean, it points out that the group that have shown the greatest decrease or the most people that quit smoking are physicians. I've talked to quite a few of them, boy. After you do a few autopsies or treat a cancer of the lung for a while, you know, then you cut him open. I mean, he's been hitting 2 or 3 packs a day and he dies at the age of 45. That's too young to die. You know? And then you see these people who become invalids, and it sort of makes a believer out of you, you know.
So you have to sort of evaluate it. But if you start smoking at a very young age, and if you smoke a couple of years, you're hooked. Some people, they say you're hooked for life. The term is better expressed. You're hooked for death, because that's really what you are. You can't really continue this. Now, in your filter question, then I'll come back to you. To answer your filter question, some filters, of course, aren't any good. But we haven't had, I don't think, at this point, enough experience over a long enough period of time. We haven't had enough experimental subjects to say this filter A is better than filter B. Certainly, there have been some improvement in this. But the best filters, and I forgot the name of them, and the best cigarettes, least hazardous, are also the least popular. I mean, they don't give it a boost for some reason or other. Now, they are doing some things with reducing, say, the arsenic content and a few other things, because maybe it isn't the tobacco, because often they use, well, if you're smoking a pipe, there shouldn't be an increase in incidence of some of this. Well, for one reason is there's probably less inhalation. You don't inhale so much. And cigars, well, I don't know. I mean, we probably don't have enough data on it yet, you see. So, but we certainly do have it on cigarette smoking. So that's about all I can say. Now, you were, Ms. Muck. Yeah. Well, yeah, they, well, I'd certainly be willing to meet with them, but a lot of times, you know, I mean, just like last year, huh? There were a few alcoholics in camp, but they didn't show up for my alcoholics lecture, you know. it's a message you'd rather not hear, because, I mean, they've been bombarded with it, and I think they probably know the statistics well as anything, but you often say, well, maybe I'd be much worse. Maybe something else would get me, or I'd be so miserable to live with that it's too much to inflict on other people. And death seems a long ways away, and it's a long time till I get old, you know. Yeah. Well, I tried to sneak it in today. You know, you notice how I mean. Just a minute, Dr. Muck. Mrs. Hodges had a point. Yeah, I've seen statistics both ways, you know. Yeah. Anybody else seen these? I mean, it's probably different, you see. If both parents are smoking, there's probably a pretty good chance that children may smoke. But if only one of them does it, you know, then often the other one may take the child out and say, look what's happening to him, you know. I mean. Dr. Muck. Yeah, it's really tragic. I mean, some of my very good friends in the medical profession, I mean, they sort of live like there's no tomorrow, you know. And I feel so bad about it. And one of the reasons, it's purely selfish. Because a lot of my tax money goes to educate them, you know. And right today, I mean, what, you're 30 years old, essentially, almost, before you're out making a nickel and really serving the public, that some of which has educated you, you know? And so you have 15 years of practice, where we'd like to have them around a little longer to do what we educated them to do, you know? Yeah, I want to get that, because I keep up on this. Now, yes?
Just a question of curiosity. Are there any benefits that can be derived, that the medical men know of, that are derived from the use of tobacco?
Well,
by the
person? It's, most people, I mean, I've talked to several of these people,
And I know one girl I worked with, a lady now, I mean, she's probably older than I am, who, if you can believe it, you know. She knows all the statistics, she knows all of this, but she says, I really enjoy it. I really enjoy it. I haven't mentioned that you also lose your taste, you know. I mean, if you quit smoking for a while, boy, I mean, things taste, I mean, well, you get your taste back, sir, you know, it's a different taste. I'll read you just a little bit of what Dr. Muck gave me early this morning. And a lot of people say, well, should I smoke when I'm pregnant? Does it affect the child? Well, there is some recent data on this. They studied pregnant English women and showed that smokers have babies weighing about a half pound less than those born of non-smoking mothers. Additional effects such as increased frequency of stillbirths were also noted in the study by Russell and his colleagues. And my evaluation of this as a biomedical scientist is that, I mean, maybe you have a certain freedom to inflict this on yourself, but you have no right to inflict it on your unborn child. And this is how I feel about this, and I feel rather strongly about it. There is also other complications, early bleeding and stuff like this. Another point I see that Dr. Muck has underlined it in Hammond. Hammond has done a lot of work on the statistics of this, and he says eliminating the coronary heart disease effect of cigarette smoking would cut the excess deaths due to smoking by at least 50%. You see, because so many people die from heart disease. There were a couple other things here that I wanted to point out, I think. Yeah, I've already pointed out, physicians ahead in smoking decline, I've already mentioned that. The greatest overall drop in smoking was recorded among physicians, almost 26% who cut down. And I'll bring this up a little bit tomorrow in my aging lecture, because the curves on that are very interesting, but that would be going ahead. Do you want to say anything else, Dr. Hodges or Dr. Pearson, on this?
Dr. Muck? Is this drug marijuana, if I remember correctly, is that something like the old hashish or the cannabis indica? Well, it's interesting to see how the authorities are trying to legalize or permit the very free use of that, almost on the same level as cigarette smoking, from what I read in the papers. And I think that's a very interesting situation.
Yeah, it's very Yes, Julie.
It is not addictive.
Will you buy that, Dr. Hodges? I'll tell you what I'm going to do, Julie. If I come back next summer, I'm going to hit. I was thinking about it this year. In our department, I mean, we have fellows who worked a lot on LSD. I just sort of observed this. But what I'll do, and there's a fellow at University of California, he's on the staff down there, and he smokes pot, and he recommends it. And he's a real nut. I was wondering why he's a very bright guy, and he always mentions, but he always has a utopian solution to everything, you know? I mean, but what I'll do, I'll prepare a lecture on these addictions, on some of this stuff. I'll collect up material in this next year, and we'll hash this out, because this is a long session, and it's an important one, because it is, as Dr. Muck points out, it's really increasing tremendously. I saw you had your hand up, Dr. Peterson.
And
You know?
There was one other thing that I thought might be mentioned as far as cervical carcinoma is concerned. We made cervical carcinoma in essentially four stages, actually, intracranial had a fifth.
Or early diagnosis. How often would you recommend to these, as far as, pap smears, papanicular smears for an examination? Or don't you want to recommend?
We do them every year.
Yeah. I think this is very important. Why I was basing, I thought it'd be higher in this, is that I thought we were catching a lot more at stage 0 and 1 now because of papanicular. I know in industry.
This is true. And actually it goes, if you can take a step farther, there's no issue with cancer of the
cervix. That's right. And progress is being made in other areas. And I think the point of this is that you don't wait till you're kind of far gone before you see your physician, you know. I mean, you should make these visits frequent. Huh? Yes, Chief. It's pretty frightful. But this brings me to my last point, and it's 1 or 2 minutes. And that is, I was going to get more into it, but our time is up. He said, how does a Christian face cancer? And of all people, we should be able to face it better than anyone else because we have a great hope. And we have to, and this is one area, if no other, where we can be a real testimony, because some of us are going to die from cancer, and we better die courageously as Christians. I'll never forget dear Edna Benson in our hometown of Richland before we moved to California. She was a real great soul, and she retired from General Electric Company. She went to a rest home in the coast. I mean, she wasn't much over 60, I guess. Her husband was much older. But she developed carcinoma, and it went to her liver, you know. And that's a wrong way to die, too, because you start turning sort of a yellowish brown, you know. And I went over to see Edna, probably a week before she died, or something, or probably a few days. But she still had her mental processes, and I'm sure she was in great misery, although under sedation. And when I saw her, I must express surprise, because I didn't even recognize her, because you know how brown they turn, you know, yellowish brown. Oh, it was awful. My eyes were all yellow, and really thin, you know. Big smile on her face. Happy to see me. We had a pleasant discussion. And she died courageously. She died a real witness. Huh? Yes?
Everyone knows it for them, and don't they have the right?
I have the personal feel that they do have the right, and I'm sure there are, I know I have patients who have not followed this, probably only upon the insistence upon the relatives, and then I leave it this way, that I will not go out and openly tell this patient that they have cancer, unless they ask me directly, and if they ask me directly, I'm going to tell them. But I strongly feel that most patients are much easier to deal with. They are much more ready to come and tell you the problems they're having if they're not hospitalized, if they know this. And I really cannot take the personality of the person who is overly nervous or apprehensive and say that there's any one person who should not be told that he has malignancy. I've seen some people that I think would just go to pieces completely. This would be completely changed and accepted. I strongly agree that this is the case. We've got things like cancer to breast. There's no question about it. They know when they have a radical mastectomy that they have cancer. And some of these, it's quite self-evident if you don't fool them. The other thing that happens in the persons who have probably abdominal malignancy and have surgery, and the relatives don't want them told, they keep it from them. I have the one personal friend whose mother-in-law died just recently, all the way through it, everybody around her was not telling her that she had it. One of my friends was a therapist in the hospital, came and told me, said, you know, she knows she has cancer. She talked to other people, but she won't talk to her own relatives, because here, they have not told her, they have not acknowledged it, so here's the blank wall between the closest ones, just because they feel that it should be withheld from their loved ones. And I think this is a very important thing. And I think it's helpful that the relative think in with this and discuss it with their physician, because many physicians, I'm sure, will just say, well, whatever the relatives say is fine, and won't make any attempt to convince them differently.
I would agree. I think it's got time. You amazed very well see a person become relaxed and settle down in their course of illness after you told them that
All right, it's we can. I'll be up at coffee break too. And were you going to, Dr. Hodges, Dr. Muck, and Dr. Peterson? Are you going to be up for coffee break? I know you're taking right off. I really appreciate you staying here. And if you have some questions around the coffee break or bug juice break, why just stop us.